I'm Meghna Chakrabarty in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Many questions remain unanswered this afternoon about the shooting at Fort Hood, Texas, that's left 12 soldiers and one civilian dead. More than 30 people were also wounded in the attack, including the primary suspect, Army psychiatrist Major Nidal Malik Hassan. He's reportedly on a ventilator in a Texas hospital. Officials are not commenting on a motive, nor are they confirming that Hassan shouted, "God is great," before opening fire. We begin today at Fort Hood, where Amanda Kim Sterrett, military editor for the Killeen Daily Herald, joins us. And Amanda, what's happening there now?
Right now, we do know that there are investigators at the scene trying to assess who fired, how many shots were fired, and really just trying to sort out what happened at the site. They don't have a lot of details for us right now.
And the attack happened at a processing center there at Fort Hood, where soon-to-be deployed soldiers are go through some kind of final processing. Do we know anything more about what was actually going on inside the room when the attack took place?
They haven't released a lot of details. I know that the site, it's called the Soldier Readiness Processing Site, and it's a series of stations that the soldiers go through in preparation, medical checks, checking paperwork to make sure they have certain shots.
And so they go through this screening how long before they're actually going to be deployed? Are these soldiers that are about to be sent out?
It's anywhere from days to weeks at the most. It's certainly not immediate.
Do we know if Major Hassan was one of the soldiers that was being processed or why he was there? Is there any indication?
Officials have not specifically said what he was doing at the site, though they did say he was facing an upcoming deployment to Afghanistan. So they've led us to believe that, yes, he was one of them who were processing to deploy.
Okay. So have officials been able to tell you anything about a motive or whether or not Hassan, as the primary suspect, knew any of the people at the processing center that were targeted?
They have not spoken about motive whatsoever, but they have indicated that he was not close with the people there, nor did he specifically target anyone. I interviewed a member of the military who is a doctor in the emergency room, and he said by the variety of wounds that came in and the different places soldiers were hit, the arms, legs, torso, it looked like a random firing. He did say that there were a lot of shots fired, though.
When we are reading reports that it was absolutely chaotic there inside the processing center with several hundred people, members of the military, and there's also reports that perhaps the confusion at the scene could have led to some misinformation yesterday about who was killed. But have officials there that you've spoken to at Fort Hood, have they ruled out whether friendly fire was involved in some of the injuries or deaths?
That was questioned, and we are being told that investigators are looking into that. There have been no confirmations nor denials.
And military officials this morning told the media that two guns were used in the shooting by the shooter. Do we know anything more about what those guns were or how they got on base there?
Officials have said there is no indication that these were military-issued weapons. They do believe that they are his personal weapons. Fort Hood soldiers and any soldier are allowed to own personal weapons, but they must register them with on-post officials. Officials are right now determining whether he actually did that or brought them in illegally.
And 13 people are confirmed having been killed, 12 of them soldiers there. Have you heard anything more about who they are or about the wounded as well?
Not at all. We do know that Thursday was sort of a makeup day there at the site, and it was units from all across post that were there.
Now, Fort Hood is the largest armored U.S. military base in the world, and it's got to be incredibly important to the community there in Killeen. How are people in town reacting? How are they doing today?
Shock is probably the best word to describe. This is a very close community, Fort Hood, and the surrounding communities very close and support a large retiree population, a huge military population, families. Right now, people are really just reaching out and doing all they can to help those in need. There are several prayer vigils happening across the communities yesterday and today, and community events are scheduled. They had opened some blood banks for donations, and they were overrun and had to turn people away.
Amanda Kim Sterrett is military editor for the Killeen Daily Herald. Amanda, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Well, as we just heard, a picture is just beginning to emerge of exactly what happened at Fort Hood and of the alleged shooter, Major Nidal Hassan. So who is he, and what do we know about him at this point? With us is Washington Post reporter Christian Davenport. He's piecing together Hassan's bio. And Christian, the Post spoke with Hassan's aunt very recently, Noelle Hassan of Falls Church, Virginia, and she told you that Hassan had endured some name-calling and harassment about his Muslim faith after 9/11. How did she say he took that?
Well, apparently not very well. I guess to the point where he even considered getting out of the service and wanted to be discharged. And she had said he even offered to pay the military back for all of the medical training he had received, and that had gone so far as to talk to an attorney as well to see what help he could get out of getting out of the services.
And he had apparently joined the military out of high school and then went to Virginia Tech, as you said, through military funding, and then became a psychiatrist also inside the military. Did she say when after 9/11 he began talking about trying to get out of the Army? Was it soon after?
It's somewhat unclear. I mean, I think it was sort of a long running thing, his dissatisfaction with the service. And also he had told some colleagues that he worked with he was not a real supporter of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan either.
So a period of years. Has the Army been able to confirm whether or not he was trying to seek discharge?
They have not confirmed that at this point.
It's worth reminding that Hassan is an American citizen. He was born here in the United States in Virginia's Roanoke Valley. What were you able to find out about his life and his family there?
Well, it appears he was born in Arlington, which is just outside of Washington, D.C., and grew up in the Roanoke Valley of southwestern Virginia, where his parents had moved. His father appears to be had some businesses, and appeared, from what we can tell, very proud of his father. But apparently, his parents did not want him to join the military.
And he joined the military right out of high school.
Right, and that's what it appeared so.
Apparently, his father died of a heart attack in 1998 at the age of 52, and his mother soon thereafter in 2001 from kidney problems. But about the rest of his family's background, it seems that there are contradictory reports about where they're from. Are they of Palestinian or Jordanian origin? What have you been able to find out about that?
I understand that they are Palestinian, but at this point, we're still trying to piece all this together. What is clear, though, and what we do know is that Hassan was a very devout Muslim and went to the Muslim Community Center regularly in Silver Spring, Maryland. And we talked to some of the people at that mosque who remembered him fairly well. One of the things that stood out about him was that he would show up for prayer sometimes in his army fatigues, in his uniform. From what we can tell, was a very serious person, very devout, and had, this was an interesting tidbit, he had filled out a form, with the mosque, which detailed, his interest to date and to find a mate. He was not married.
He was looking for a wife through the help of the mosque.
Right. And on his form, he made it very clear that he wanted someone who was deeply religious, who prayed five times a day. And he talked a little bit about himself and said that, he as a person was quite reserved and didn't open up automatically to other people, and which is, what some of his coworkers had also said and his family as well. We talked to a former coworker of his when he was stationed at Walter Reed Army Medical Center and served as a psychiatrist and was, from what we can tell, helping counsel soldiers. And as you know, at Walter Reed, they have really sort of the most severely wounded of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And he would have been counseling them before he was transferred to Texas and to Fort Hood. But one of his coworkers there said he was somewhat standoffish, somewhat isolated, didn't like, for example, they would have big Christmas gatherings during the holidays, and he didn't like to be in photographs with other women there and sort of steer cleared. And one of the coworkers said that they weren't always so keen on sending patients to him be because of his behavior and his reclusivity.
He was counseling some of the most horribly injured soldiers who had been fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan. And did he ever speak to his family about his thoughts on that, or how seeing those wounded soldiers had an effect on him?
He did. He did. And his aunt told us that it affected him a great deal. And she talked about one of the people he had come across in particular, who had suffered some really severe burns, and she had talked about how that had really had made quite an impact on him.
It seems that there's a very interesting and compelling sort of winding track of his military background, but off base, there's also questions about alleged internet activity, so that the FBI maybe began to look into internet posts under his name where he or someone under his name allegedly compares suicide bombers to soldiers who saved the life of their comrades. What do we know about these postings?
Right. There was some postings on a website under a screen name, Nidal Hussein. And, you know, obviously we don't know if he's the one who made these postings. And on these postings he talks about suicide bombers and compares them to Japanese kamikaze pilots, and how that they were sacrificing themselves for a greater cause.
And so it's interesting that there could potentially be these postings that he made about suicide bombings. CNN is showing video from yesterday morning where a man allegedly, Major Hussein, is at the local 7-Eleven buying coffee wearing traditional Muslim garb. And there's also, as of yet unconfirmed, but eyewitness reports that he shouted the Arabic phrase Allahu Akbar, or God is great, just before allegedly opening fire at that processing center. But yet you also report that in his army records, Major Hussein reports no religious preference.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's something of a contradiction. He on his official army records, he had no religious preference, but clearly he was very devout. And well known at his mosque, and if that is in fact him in that video at the convenience store, you can see how he's dressed in the traditional garb.
Washington Post reporter Christian Davenport, one of the reporters on the paper's biography of Major Nidal Hussein. I'm sure you'll be continuing to follow this. Christian, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Just ahead, a town in Massachusetts puts out the welcome mat for detainees at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba, saying if they're cleared of terrorism, they can resettle there. And also a bit of music from The Walkmen. Back in a minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. Later this month, President Barack Obama is expected to announce his plans for prosecuting some of the prisoners at the Guantanamo Bay Detention Center. Will they be tried in federal courts on U.S. soil or face military commissions at the facility? Roughly 215 people are detained at Guantanamo Bay. 60 or so are expected to be prosecuted. About 80 are waiting to be released. But where will they go? One Massachusetts town has voted in favor of taking some of the detainees from Guantanamo Bay. Although Amherst, Massachusetts is known for taking liberal positions on foreign policy, this issue has divided the town. Here and Now's Deborah Becker brings us this report.
Mr. Moderator, we have a quorum.
At the Amherst special town meeting this week, reaching a quorum meant that at least 123 town meeting members were there to vote. Not exactly a huge crowd, but in a town where a popular T-shirt reads Amherst, where only the H is silent, lengthy debate is a given, especially on an issue like the Guantanamo Bay prison.
I've certainly been very concerned about Guantanamo. I wanted it to close it. I even demonstrated in front of the Supreme Court a year ago, January, with my orange jumpsuit on about closing Guantanamo.
Longtime town meeting member Ruth Hook sponsored the two-part non-binding resolution on behalf of the newly formed group, the Pioneer Valley No More Guantanamos. It urges Congress to lift the ban on allowing Guantanamo detainees into the U.S. and welcomes the men who are cleared to Amherst.
obviously, if we're going to close Guantanamo, we have to have a place for all of the people there to go. Why not Amherst?
While Hook is no stranger to bringing foreign policy matters up at town meeting, the Guantanamo resolution gained some unlikely supporters.
It's kind of hard to define in Amherst what a conservative would be, I guess. But yeah, I'm considered to be the conservative in Amherst.
Town meeting member Larry Kelly proudly lists his votes opposing past town meeting articles. But he says this time, after being assured that no town services would go to support the detainees, he's siding with the left.
I railed against the town when they canceled West Side Story, when they allowed the high school to be the only one in the entire country to perform Vagina Monologues. But because of my love for all the things that the flag represents, if these people really didn't do anything, then I have no problem with them living here.
An unlikely no vote came from Select Board Chairwoman Stephanie O'Keefe. She says she understands the intent of the resolution, but if Washington is having trouble figuring out what to do with men it once suspected of being terrorists, then how can Amherst decide?
I have no expertise on this at all. I can only assume that the idea of cleared detainees is more complicated than I understand, than town meeting understands. So if people feel strongly that the Guantanamo situation needs to be fixed, they can express that to their congressmen, to their senators, the people who are dealing with all of the information about this.
Mohammed Ibrahim also finds himself in a different place than usual on this issue. He's a member of the Amherst Human Rights Commission and a victim of torture in Sudan. Amherst, Ibrahim says, would think differently about welcoming someone like talk show host Rush Limbaugh.
If a right-wing fanatic person from your own country excuses, like if Rush Limbaugh, for example, asks for refugee and take refuge in Amherst, every single person would say no.
Although the resolution does not specify which detainees might come to Amherst, the supporters named two men they say have been cleared, but cannot return to their home countries because of possible reprisals. Ibrahim says one of the men has a questionable past that should be investigated, which the supporters deny. But those types of questions made Claire Bertrand vote no.
Even if they are all not guilty, the fact that they've gone through this experience, I'm not sure Amherst is the place where they should come and live. That does not feel to me like the next logical jump. I would say there is a lot of other work that has to be done to secure the physical and mental health of these people.
The Pioneer Valley No More Guantanamo's group says as Congress figures out how to close Guantanamo by January as promised, the country should take responsibility for the men it's wrongly imprisoned. The group says it's taking note of the strong reaction in Amherst in drafting similar resolutions in communities across the country.
That report from Here and Now's Deborah Becker. And now an update to our top story. President Barack Obama says the whole nation is grieving over the mass killings at Fort Hood in Texas yesterday, a shooting that killed 13 people, one civilian, and 12 soldiers.
From now until Veterans Day, I've ordered the flags at the White House and other federal buildings to be flown at half staff. This is a modest tribute to those who lost their lives, even as many were preparing to risk their lives for their country. And it's also a recognition of the men and women who put their lives on the line every day to protect our safety and uphold our values.
Obama urged people not to jump to conclusions while law enforcement officials continue to gather facts about the suspected shooter, Major Nidal Hassan, who was an Army psychiatrist. Major Hassan, who is still alive, is an American and a Muslim with Palestinian roots. The Associated Press reports that Hassan told a neighbor in downtown Killeen that he was going to be deployed today. And yesterday and the day before, he stopped by to offer her furniture from his apartment and a Quran. The Killeen Daily Herald is reporting neighbors noticed Hassan had recently taken to wearing Arabic clothing. Despite troubles in his previous job, one of his bosses at Fort Hood described him as, quote, a quiet man who didn't seek the limelight. And she praised him, saying, up to this point, I would consider him an asset at the base. Monday on Here and Now, the 20th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall. We'll have a report from Berlin. And for people who get health insurance through their jobs, this is the time to rethink your benefits. You might want to do your wallet a favor and open that letter from your employer. That's Monday. Still ahead today, the Supreme Court will hear two cases next year about juvenile justice. Should teenagers be given a life sentence in prison without the chance for parole? The news is up next, Here and Now. Imagine standing on your street. It's a street you've crossed 1,000 times. Now imagine that the city decides to close that street and you can't cross it. And the only way to get to work, to the hospital, or to the grocery store is to walk miles up the road where there's another safe crossing. Sounds infuriating, doesn't it? Well, that's exactly what's happened on the borders of New York and Vermont, right along Lake Champlain. On October 16th, inspectors discovered that two of the piers holding up the Lake Champlain Bridge had deteriorated so badly the structure might collapse. So they closed the bridge indefinitely and left thousands of people who use the bridge each day stranded and struggling to figure out how to get across the lake. Well, joining us from West Addison, Vermont, is Lisa Cloutier. She's owner of The Bridge Restaurant, and it sits right at the foot of the Lake Champlain Bridge. Lisa, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you.
So what has the bridge closure done to your business?
It has really decimated my business. I'm sitting right now in my dining room, and it's totally empty, and I'm looking out at the bridge with no cars going across it.
And this is a time of day where you usually have a lot of people there at the restaurant?
We would have a lot of passerbys and a lot of regular customers from New York. I have an 80-20 split, 80 New York, 20 Vermont.
And you say that you've lost your community, you've cut off from roughly half your community from the folks who are on the New York side. I mean, Lake Champlain is really big. It's 120 miles long. And there, you know, maybe aren't as many places to cross on a bridge as you might like. So can you give us a sense as to how the closure has really affected the entire region beyond your business there?
Oh, it's just so huge. A lot of New Yorkers work over here in Vermont. And, I mean, their 9-hour days have turned into 13, 14-hour days. I mean, and it's for all the businesses. I mean, the hospitals. I mean, you know, like the people in New York relied on our emergency services over here. The magnitude of this is just like it's worse than an earthquake because you're still feeling it.
You're still feeling it. And you say that people have to go way out of their way to actually get across the lake now. Other than the ferries that are running on the water there, where's the next place to cross the lake?
The ferries are positioned like 30 miles north or 20 miles south. And otherwise, you do a 100-mile detour.
Hmm. And so the ferries are able to take like 10 or 20 cars across at a time. And that's for as long as the water is liquid. What are you guys going to do come winter?
Right at the moment, nothing is 100% certain, but things are moving along a little bit to the positive side. Right here at the corridor where the bridge is, the state of Vermont and New York are working to try to put in a ferry service right out here in front of the restaurant to open up this corridor because this is the main artery to all the communities. So they're trying to get a ferry in here and have it be 24 hours, 7 days a week.
But is that ferry going to be able to run year-round? I mean, I know
yes,
it gets really...
It'll be two ferries, a big icebreaker plus a smaller ferry, because you've had 3,400 to 4,000 cars go across that bridge a day.
From what you describe, it seems like the region is really struggling and kind of in an economic mess right now. Who do you blame for all of this happening to you so suddenly?
Well, quite frankly, I blame both the states of Vermont and New York. New York was responsible to maintain the bridge, and it's grossly been neglected. But on the same token, Vermont owns half of it. They should have stepped up to the plate and saw that the maintenance should have been getting done when it should have been, and it wasn't.
I have to wonder, though, I mean, what kind of choice authorities had, because from what I understand, the design of the Lake Champlain Bridge is very similar to that bridge that collapsed in Minneapolis in 2007, and 13 people died then. And so what other choice did they have? What could they have done, I mean, if the bridge was in danger of imminent collapse?
Well, it seems that they could have moved faster at getting something going with the ferries down here, because 4 days after the bridge was closed, I had a meeting with our local representatives, our local senators, and, you know, a lot of business people came to this meeting, big and small, like Goodrich, Porter Hospital, and we threw out a lot of suggestions, and it fell on deaf ears. And this is now 3 weeks later, and now they're picking up one of the suggestions and possibly going forward with a ferry. You know, I feel things could have moved faster. I don't think that either state realized how much of an economic impact and a hardship that this created for everybody in the communities.
Lisa Cloutier owns the Bridge Restaurant in West Addison, Vermont, on the side where Vermont has been cut off from neighboring New York State due to the closure of the Lake Champlain Bridge. Lisa, thank you so much for joining us, and really best of luck to you up there in Vermont.
Thank you.
The United States is one of just 11 countries in the world that sentences children to life in prison without parole. And the U.S., along with Israel, are the only two countries that have actually sent children to prison for life. Right now, about 2,500 minors between the ages of 13 and 17 are serving life sentences in the U.S., 111 of them for crimes that never involved a homicide. That's according to recent congressional testimony. But the United States Supreme Court could change that next week when it hears the cases of two Florida men who were sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole when they were teens. For more, we turn to Amy Bach, who writes for the online magazine Slate. Amy, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you so much.
Amy, on Monday, the Supreme Court's going to hear these two separate cases. Can you sketch out the basics of what they're going to hear?
Yes. One involves a 13-year-old named Joe Sullivan, convicted of raping a 70-something-year-old woman. He was also convicted of burglary, of breaking into her house. Another involves a 17-year-old boy named Terrence Graham, who was convicted of robbery and was sentenced on the basis of the fact that he violated his probation. The second crime he committed, which was burglary, he was never actually tried for.
So Joe Sullivan was 13 at the time he was convicted. It's been roughly 20 years since then. He's in his 30s now. And Terrence Graham, it's been many years since he was convicted as a 17-year-old. But, of course, the issue here is that they were handed these life sentences without the possibility of parole when they were juveniles. So when the attorneys for Graham and Sullivan stand before the court, what exactly are they going to be arguing?
They're basically going to be arguing a follow-up to a 2005 case called Roper versus Simmons. There, the court held that it's unconstitutional to impose the death penalty on children under the age of 18. The lawyers will argue that a life sentence without parole for a juvenile is unconstitutional for similar reasons. And the reasons were really laid out by Justice Anthony Kennedy in Roper, and he explained that children are less blameworthy than adults because they're less mature and their sense of responsibility is not fully developed. They're more vulnerable to negative influences like peer pressure, and they have no ability to control or to escape a terrible home or negative environments as an adult would. An adult could leave, a child is stuck there, and so his context therefore creates a situation where he's less culpable for his acting out.
And part of that lesser culpability comes from emerging neuroscience about juvenile brains.
Exactly. Emerging neuroscience shows that there's a greater chance for rehabilitation because personality traits and character are not fixed. These are things that can change over time. Basically, what the lawyers are arguing is that life without parole is like a death sentence. It's final, it's irreversible, it's saying the person will never be fit in society. But this doesn't jibe with what neuroscience and social science shows, that juveniles do change. They're not saying these kids shouldn't get punished. They're not saying that we shouldn't put these kids in jail for a very, very long time, but that children should be given the opportunity to have their sentences reviewed later in their lives by some authority, you know, who's been entrusted with making parole decisions. That is all it's arguing. It's not arguing that children should be released from prison.
Both cases came out of Florida. What is the state of Florida going to argue in front of the court?
The state of Florida is going to say this. These may be juveniles, but these kids did adult crime. And as the saying goes, adult crime, adult time. And that Roper, the case I mentioned that Justice Kennedy wrote, Roper doesn't apply because this case involves life without parole. And that this is not a death case. And the states can do what they want when death is not an issue.
Maybe it's worth taking a step back at the moment and just sort of looking at what exactly is the process of trying juveniles in this country. Who gets the decision on what sentence to go after and what charges to bring, et cetera?
Well, it differs from every state. In some places, the prosecutor has to go before the judge and get a waiver, for example, to say, here are the circumstances for this kid. This kid has monster tendencies. Therefore, I see him, you know, as somebody who we should lock away for a very long period of time and not be able to be let out when he's 18 as a juvenile. But in some places, like Florida, the prosecutor has very little check on him. It's very easy to bring things in adult court. For example, in the case of Joe Sullivan, the prosecutor never, even when it came time to sentencing, had to really describe who this kid was, what his mental ability was, what his family situation was, whether he'd ever done any good things, what his past crimes, in fact, really were.
In looking at his trial in particular, you did some pretty deep research, and not only did you raise questions about sort of the prosecutorial decision-making and what sentences to go after, but the trial itself, and that maybe he didn't even receive a fair trial. Can you just briefly go over that?
Yeah, his trial, you know, I spent the past 8 years writing about courts across America and the kind of justice that regular people receive. I have not seen a trial transcript like this. His lawyer made no opening statement. His lawyer made a closing statement that was only a few lines long. His lawyer never properly questioned the two other witnesses against him who were his friends. There was no real checking of the facts in this case. And Joe Sullivan has always maintained his innocence. And, you know, he may or he may not be innocent, but he never really had a lawyer who tried to bring out the facts of what really happened.
Well, Joe Sullivan and Terrence Graham, as we mentioned earlier, are two of some 2,500 juveniles who are serving life sentences in the United States now. And it's absolutely worth mentioning that on every one of these convictions, there were victims on the other end who were probably very happy to see some form of justice done. But on the other hand, what's really going on in the world of jurisprudence that's brought all these juvenile justice issues to the Supreme Court recently?
Well, I think part of the history has to do with the early 90s. There was this huge spike in juvenile crime. At the same time, and this is interesting, the adult system was getting simultaneously tougher. There was all this talk about a super predator. This super predator is this very dangerous person that we have to lock him up and throw away the key. And there began to be these slogans, adult crime, adult time. And this is the kind of political will that made states change their laws to make sure that juveniles couldn't get out when they were done at age 18.
What do experts you've talked to think may come out of these two cases that the court's going to hear?
I got to tell you, the experts are really split on this one. Some people are saying that Joe Sullivan's case, there are only two individuals serving life without parole for a non-homicide offense at age 13. And so a lot of people have great hope that the court may draw some sort of line and say, well, for something like this that is so out there, so out of proportion to what everybody else in America is doing, there's a problem. But we don't want children, you know, who are age 13 going for life without possibly parole. Now, the Supreme Court may draw some sort of line maybe and say for kids of a certain age, it's not okay. And then for kids over a certain age, maybe perhaps 17, they'll split the difference somehow. But it's a toss-up. Nobody knows.
Well, Amy Bach writes for the online magazine Slate, and she's also author of Ordinary Injustice, How America Holds Court. Amy Bach, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world, uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Welcome back to Here and Now.
Well, it's back to the battle. But I wouldn't have it any other way.
Indie rockers The Walkmen have known each other for a long time, since they were kids. Their music has grown along with them. Critics have called the New York-based band masters of moody rock, driven by growling vocals. Others have compared their sound to Bob Dylan and U2. But recently, The Walkmen have mellowed. As they age, have kids, what was once a noisier, harder rock is giving way to lighter, throwback ballads.
You are the morning, and I am the night.
The Walkmen are on the road right now, and Here and Now's Jill Ryan caught up with them at a recent concert in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Hamilton Lighthouser's lilting voice makes him sound like a handsome suitor serenading his love. Actually, he was singing to a dark room of sweaty 20-somethings at a recent concert in Cambridge, Massachusetts, but fans were swooning.
They played like it was the last show they were ever going to play in their lives, and they put everything they have into it.
I had to actually make myself stop listening to the album because I was listening to it like every day, like twice a day, and I didn't want to get myself like sick of the album.
It reminded me a little bit like they're very Dylan inspired, but I think that Bob Dylan, if he saw him, he'd be like, I wish I could sing like that.
Lighthouser's band, The Walkmen, came together in 2000 out of the ashes of two other indie groups, and the sound that emerged was all jangly guitars and bursting drums, like what you hear in their 2004 hit single, The Rat, chosen as one of the 20 best songs of the decade by the music website Pitchfork. But that was then. Now band members are older, some married with kids. Lighthouser says the Walkmen are shifting their direction.
The hard rockers are like from our earlier records. The ones we like playing are the tame, sort of swingy or shuffly kind of stuff. It's light and it's breezy and it sounds like a hard rock band going over the hill or something, you know?
Maturity has also brightened the Walkmen's mood. Their 2002 debut album was titled Everyone Who Pretended to Like Me Is Gone. But today the songs have dreamy titles like 7 Years of Holidays, Donde Está la Playa, aka Where is the Beach, and In the New Year.
I think when you're younger, when maybe you have more of a tendency to try to say something negative because it sounds cool. I think as you're older, it's, you know, feels more appropriate to be positive.
That's organist Walter Martin. He says growing up was something much of the band did together while attending the same grade school in Washington, D.C. Martin says they even started a rock band in the fifth grade.
Matt, our drummer, joined us in the seventh grade, and then Paul joined us in the ninth grade. So we've done it since, you know, I don't know, like 20 years.
Guitarist Paul Maroon jokes that the group's sound has only gotten worse since then, when they imitated a type of English white reggae inspired by the Jamaican ska style. Now Maroon cites Roy Orbison and Elvis as influences, which may explain a bit of the Walkmen's swaying throwback sound.
Stuck in a time warp, actually. I don't think we use anything that we couldn't have used 40 years ago. We could sort of be from any era of rock and roll, basically.
If only it were true, I'd go with you. If only
To get that timeless sound, Maroon plays a hollow-body electric guitar like the Beatles did in their early days. The band recently added a horn section, and another signature sound comes from a 50-year-old upright piano that adds a carnivalish twinkle.
Well, I'm the man.
perhaps even more vintage is the Walkman's low-tech recording style. They just point a microphone at an instrument, and it gives the music a spacious, underwater feel. Walter Martin especially hears it in their first album.
It sounded like it was recorded in a cave, but people sort of got into that, and so it's easy to duplicate.
Yeah. All you have to do is not know what you're doing. Yeah. It's very, very easy.
What's not easy, says guitarist Paul Maroon, is lugging that few hundred-pound upright piano around the country.
We actually dropped one once. It fell out of the back of our truck. And it went into probably like 5,000 pieces. And this big cloud of dust popped up and right in the middle of the street. And it's not like you can clean it up either.
But the Walkman played on. And those hazards of road life, the long van rides, and sharing one backstage bathroom with a dozen others all seem to melt away when the Walkman meet their adoring fans.
Remember the guy who, like, at the parking lot, like a Panera or something, pulled up next to us? Like, where are you guys headed, man? He's like, you guys are living the dream. He's like sort of middle-aged guy with his wife. He just about to get in his car, but he decided to come and say, like, you guys are awesome for piling into the van.
Many nights. That's Walter Martin of The Walkman. For more on the band, go to our website, hereandnow.org. Our story was produced by Here and Now's Jill Ryan. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Robin Young is back on Monday. Join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.